Hello. My Bowdoin students are somewhat ambivalent about theory. I teach a variety of different courses at Bowdoin on archaeology. My students are often fairly surprised when they begin to take the courses that archaeology has any theory whatsoever. But as they get into it, they see perhaps the relevance, the utility of archaeological theory. But at the same time, it's not their favorite part of the discipline. What I often do then, after having talked with my students about theory for a few lectures, is to try and give them some concrete examples of how this theory may play out in practice. Issues of archaeological interpretation, issues of cultural evolution, whatever. So I think that's a good thing to do here as well. Over the last few lectures, then, I've been talking about some issues that involve archaeological understandings about political and cultural evolution and what that means archaeologically. And I'll be talking about that a little bit more in my next lecture as well. But I think at this point, it may be a good example to change the pace a little bit, to actually turn our attentions from archaeological theory and take a look at a concrete example of some of the challenges that archaeologists face when we do this kind of work. So, much of the archaeological discussion of ancient states and civilizations has to do with questions of social scale and coordination. How can large numbers of people live and cooperate together in a single, interrelated social and political system? It's not surprising that the appearance of early states is so often also the appearance of urbanism. As people learn to live together in towns and cities, and as the mechanisms that allow them to do so and to coordinate their efforts communally become more elaborate. To the extent that in the past, state formation has often been more or less equated with urbanism. The assumption is that when one has a town, one has the state. However, we know archaeologically that the two do not always go together. We can have towns without states, and we can have states without towns. The challenge for archaeologists, then, lies in determining the nature of governance in ancient societies, and particularly in those societies, those precursors to states, where rulers and their convenient habits of material display did not yet exist. In an earlier lecture, I talked about Shelley and that poem Ozymandias. But the great thing about Ramses II is that he talked, or he had people talk for him about what he did at great length and in great detail, which is very useful for archaeologists. But what about those societies? What about those communities before those habits of declamation came into being? One of the challenges for archaeologists, one of the perhaps the preeminent challenge in all of archaeology, not merely when we're looking at ancient states, ancient civilizations, but for all of archaeology, is understanding the origins and the gaps within the analogies, the modern analogies, the ethnographic analogies, the historical analogies that we use to understand ancient societies. And this is a profound issue within our discipline. How do we understand, potentially, theoretically, how do we understand an ancient community, an ancient society which has no modern analogs, or an ancient behavior, an ancient technology, an ancient social system which has no modern analogs or no ethnographic analogs or no historical analogs. How do we understand something very different than what we know? We make those analogies all the time. We make them constantly in archaeology. How do we test them? How do we know we can rely on them? These challenges are well illustrated by the archaeological site of Shetalhoyuk, which is a Neolithic and agricultural settlement on the Konya Plain of southern Anatolia in modern Turkey. Shetalhoyuk is dated to between about 7400 and 6000 BC. It was occupied for almost 1500 years. It's a fascinating site. It's an amazing site. Shetalhoyuk, at the height of its occupation, was the largest settlement that we know of in the world at that time. The largest settlement that had ever existed in the world until that time, with a population of perhaps 5,000 to 8,000 people. What we might now call a small town. But there's that term. There's our analogy. There's our analog. We're talking about a town. The question is, should we be at Shetalhoyuk? The site itself, as you can see on this slide, is on a set of mounds in southern Anatolia. Both of these mounds are artificial. They're the remains of centuries upon centuries of occupation on the site. And excavation has gone on both of these mounds. And this is very large-scale excavation. Anytime archaeologists can afford to build a shelter like this over their excavations, it's a big deal. What do we know about Shetalhoyuk? These people lived in very densely packed households, entered only through the roof of their houses, and without any streets, alleys, or public spaces separating them. You can see the image here, an artist's conception of what Shetalhoyuk would have looked like when it was actually occupied. And what you need to think of is this very, very large area with tightly packed houses. And keep this in mind. No public spaces that we know of in the settlement at all. There are no pathways between the houses. There are no parks. There are no communal areas where the settlement could meet for any particular reason. When occupied, the site probably looked a little like a pueblo community in the American Southwest, albeit perhaps more enclosed and inward-looking. The people at Shetalhoyuk were farmers. They were mostly cultivating the wheat and barley that were at that time, 7500 BC, being taken up by new farming populations across the Near East. Wheat and barley, you know, cereals, we talk about the staff of life, the foundation of a food system, as well as other domesticated crops like, for example, peas and lentils. One of the interesting things about this site, one of the mysterious things about this site, in a sense, is that it's actually not in a very good area for farming. Much of it seems to have been too wet, almost swampy. And so one of the questions about Shetalhoyuk then is, why were people living there? If they're farmers, why were they living there? It's possible that almost 9,000 years ago, that more of this land was well-drained and suitable for farming than is the case, but it's quite likely that the farmers living at Shetalhoyuk were going out some distance away from the settlement in order to work the fields. In terms of animals, sheep and goats were domesticated. We'll talk in later lectures about the agricultural package, if you like, that develops in the Near East between 5,000 and 10,000 years ago. And the farmers at Shetalhoyuk were making use of this package. Wheat, barley, peas, lentils, sheep, and goats. There has for a long time been a great deal of argument about whether cattle were domesticated at Shetalhoyuk. And it now appears that they weren't. There are lots of cattle remains on the site, but it appears that these are the remains of wild cattle, not domesticated ones. And this is interesting, as we'll see in a moment, given their importance on the site. Çatalhöyük has been excavated twice. When it was first excavated in the early 1960s, it was described by the excavator, James Millard, as a Neolithic town. There's that term. Organized much like modern towns, with certain areas set aside for religious activities, probably for other kinds of activities as well. Millard never really described in any detail what he thought the political organization of the town had been, but it was usually assumed to involve some kind of central leadership, perhaps, if you like, as a very early chiefdom. There's that term that I'm going to be mentioning a great number of times in the course of these lectures. That was the first excavation of Çatalhöyük. But what I want to note here is that term town. Because for us, that one word, town, involves an entire set of meanings and assumptions and agreements about what life in a town is like. But the question is whether that term that we use and that we understand today as the town provides a good analogy that we can use to interpret the remains at Çatalhöyük. A very large-scale archaeological project, an extraordinarily large archaeological project actually, has been undertaken on the site of Çatalhöyük since 1993 and directed by Ian Hodder, an archaeologist now at Stanford. And it provides a different, and I think in many ways a more interesting, view of life at Çatalhöyük, and I think also a more accurate view of life at Çatalhöyük as well. One of the things to note is that if you're ever interested in this excavation at Çatalhöyük has been written up in two extremely good books written for the general public, one by a science writer named Michael Balter called The Goddess and the Bull, and Ian Hodder's own book, The Leopard's Tale. And it's interesting to have good general writing on an archaeological project is a wonderful thing in the first place, from my point of view, and to have two good books on a single site and a single project on a site is great. So what do we know from these later excavations at Çatalhöyük? Well, the site was not laid out as a town, as we understand the word today. That's the first thing we know. You can see on this image some of the walls covering one of the very large excavation units at Çatalhöyük. And what we see is the site existing as a collection of individual households. But there's no evidence for social hierarchy or for municipal political authority. If anything, we would need to think of Çatalhöyük perhaps better as an extremely large farming village with 5,000 to 8,000 people living there. When I say extremely large, I'm quite large. And organized with a household pattern that, at least for us in the West, is fairly unfamiliar. There is some evidence for feasting on the site. And this is indeed the most obvious form of communal activity at Çatalhöyük. Now, feasting is something that we encounter both in the ethnographic and historical record. And one of the interesting things about feasts is that the giving of feasts, the hosting of feasts, in many societies without very much political centralization becomes a pathway towards a form of power, or at least a form of status that one can hold in the society. It's taking hospitality, taking generosity, and if you like, feasts deploy hospitality and generosity for social and political ends. So to find feasts evidence for feasting in the form of particular deposits in garbage disposal areas of the site, to find evidence of feasting at Shetal Hayuk is significant not merely as a culinary experience, but also as a political and social initiative. Feasts seem to have been held periodically, and they often involve people from more than one household. They seem to have been especially related to the construction or refurbishment of houses, and they involved eating meat from wild bulls. I talked about the cattle, the fact that we have cattle remains at Shetal Hayuk, and they're from wild animals. Much of the day-to-day and ritual activity at Shetal Hayuk seems to have been focused on the individual households, with relatively little evidence for cooperative activity at the community level beyond those feasts that I just mentioned. There have been some nice reconstructions done, for example, of Building 25 at Shetal Hayuk. An exterior reconstruction would show Building 25, and you would have to think of Building 25 as surrounded, tightly packed other houses, more or less with the same features and the same appearance. And then if we looked inside, what we would see would be a ladder leading down from the only doorway in the building, which, as I've noted, is going to be on the roof. And then inside, a number of rooms. We have sleeping platforms, in which obviously people are going to use for sleeping, but also for work and other kinds of social activity. And one would not see a great deal of variation among these houses at Shetal Hayuk. The houses were the focus of extraordinary ritual activities, often engaged in repeatedly over months, years, and decades. Study of microdebris, tiny fragments of bone, of ceramic, of chips of stone from stone tools, left on the floors of different rooms, indicate that the activities that went on in different parts of the household were highly restricted. One didn't just move around to find a more convenient place to make dinner or to refurbish tools. One did it in a particular place, and that place did not vary from house to house. Rooms were cleaned and replastered at very frequent intervals, up to 450 times over the 75 to 100-year time span of a single house. The archaeologists working there have minutely examined the millimeter-thick tracings of different plastering episodes in these rooms, building up a detailed history of these events. In many cases, walls were not merely replastered, but also repainted. And you can see the painstaking work that's necessary to undertake to study these replastering episodes, which do seem to be very important in the lifespan of these houses. And here we see some of the images that are then revealed. Ritual items, often including animal elements, like wild bull skulls with the horns attached, were also incorporated into household shrines. And Ian Hodder, the director of the excavations, believes that these wild bull skulls were the remains of the feasts that took place when houses were first built or refurbished. Beyond being cleaned and replastered, houses were carefully rebuilt on the same ground plans, sometimes more than five times in a century. They were rebuilt on exactly the same ground plans. Dead family members were buried under the floors of the home. So you have to think of these images of the floors, the sleeping platforms in the houses of Shetal Hayuk. When you went to sleep at Shetal Hayuk, you knew that there were ancestors, that there were members of your family buried just underneath you. These family members were not merely buried under the floors of the home, but they were then periodically disinterred. They were dug up again for some form of ceremonies. This seems to have involved the removal of the heads of the cadavers, from the bodies of some of the dead people. And their exchange with other individuals and between households within the Shetalhoyuk community is that the heads are actually being, the skulls are actually being moved around within the community, after which they would often be reburied in the foundations of later homes. Bull skulls and some sculptures were sometimes treated in the same way. Now we can see how this might make sense ideologically. Shetalhoyuk people seem to have associated the bodies of people with the bodies of houses. If dead ancestors remain important within the household, as they do in many parts of the world today, and are buried under the floors of the house, they could be seen metaphorically as the foundation of that household, both the building and the people. In the area I work in northern Cameroon, the household itself, the word, the word in the Chadic language, Platla, where I work, for a household is Dutundes Adao, the people who live in the belly of the house. And again, these people are buried under the floors. The circulation and reburial of parts of the bodies of the dead at Shetalhoyuk might then be a way of distributing the strength of the ancestors in both social and architectural terms. Ian Hodder believes that the repetitive rituals performed in the symbolically charged houses at Shetalhoyuk provided a potent mechanism for the socialization of community members, which may help explain how a relatively large and very dense community could function without significant central authority. Here we have an image of what this perhaps might have looked like, the burial of a member of the community, a member of the household, under the floor of the house. And we're left to imagine the kinds of activities, the kinds of rituals that would have then accompanied the disinterment of these bodies, their sharing in the community as a way of gaining access to the power, to the strength, to the history of ancestors. It's very much a different way of thinking of how authority works. I want to emphasize, though, the importance of this. There is, as far as we know, no central coordinating authority at the site of Shetalhoyuk. Okay? We have not found any evidence yet for a ruler at Shetalhoyuk. We have not found any evidence, as far as we can see at this point, for a governing council. We have nothing. We have the houses at Shetalhoyuk are, if you like, they're not copies of one another, but they are expressions of the same cultural and social plan, and they repeat across the site. Now, Hodder's idea that the house itself was in some sense disciplining its members would be a very strange idea to most of us. It really is quite a strange idea. The concept here is almost that the intensive repetition and memory making that we see expressed all through the site, the regular, repeated, frequent replastering of the walls, the sense in which there are certain areas of the site that are set aside, certain areas of each household that are set aside for very particular activities. The fact that the house was cleaned out so frequently the fact that on regular intervals the house was rebuilt, and not merely rebuilt, but rebuilt directly upon the foundations of its predecessor, with the same layout of rooms, with the same layout of walls, with the same arrangement. The house was in a sense being reborn, but it was being reborn in the image of what had gone before. So Hodder's belief then is that the intensive repetition and memory making that we see expressed all through the site at Çatalhöyük was training people to live together in a community far larger and far more permanent than any that had ever existed on Earth before. Not in any conscious sense, it's not as if this was a plan, but as a way of structuring social and ideological relationships. We would have to think of this, in a sense, we live in communities today that are structured by both private and public constraints. We have our private constraints about we know how to live together. There are circumstances of politeness. There are circumstances, a whole set of ways of behaving, because we're behaving in communities of thousands or hundreds of thousands of or millions of people. But we also have, besides these private constraints, we have a whole set of public constraints that work upon us. We have laws. We have traffic signals. We have police. We have this whole panoply of cultural and social forces that direct and constrain our activity. For the people at Çatalhöyük, those did not exist. Those public constraints, those public forces did not exist. It was the private. It was the things of the household at Çatalhöyük that allowed people to live together. It's almost as if the people at Çatalhöyük, through this intensely private, repetitive memory making, this sense of living in a world that works in a very particular way. It's as if people were being domesticated to live together, just as at exactly the same time. Their crops and their herd animals, wheat, barley, peas, lentils, goats, sheep, not cattle yet, remember that, not cattle yet, but their crops and their herd animals were being domesticated by the people who were living on the site, but they were domesticating themselves at the same time. They were learning how to live together in a very particular way. The fascinating thing is about Çatalhöyük, many things about the site are fascinating. It's an extraordinary site. But it's a way of living together that does not persist. After Çatalhöyük is abandoned, we don't tend to see people living in the same way in this communal but at the same time household-focused manner that existed at Çatalhöyük. In later agricultural villages in the Near East, even in Anatolia, you will find people living in individual households, much more like we would expect to see in a modern village, with households separated from one another, and some of the same practices, but not the same manner of living, not the same architectural form. That stopped. I wouldn't say that this was a failed experiment. It was one that lasted for 1,500 years. But the interesting thing is that it did not persist in this region. Çatalhöyük was not the precursor to any state. But research on the site of Çatalhöyük demonstrates that life in even quite large communities could, in ancient times, be organized in ways very different than we expect. And it also illustrates the importance and the danger, as well as the opportunity, of the analogs that we use to structure our understanding of ancient societies. Thank you.